I want you to, let's start with 1 Samuel chapter 5, when the ark is in Ashdod and they try to move it to Ekron. The Philistines are traveling all over their country, or all over the area, trying to find a place to put the ark. And as it turns out, nobody wants it. And I don't know how violent it got, but when they came to Ekron, I would think they were right on the verge of a civil war, and making sure that it did not come in. They did not know exactly what to do with it. And the reasons why are because of these verses. And the first one I want you to look at is verse 6. The Lord's hand was heavy on the people of Ashdod and its vicinity. He brought devastation on them and afflicted them with tumors. There's a footnote down at the bottom of the NIV. Did you go over this? Did y'all go over this, Bill? A little bit? Okay. There's a footnote, and the footnote comes from the Septuagint. And the Vulgate translation used the Septuagint. Now, you know, the Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible. And it's the one that a lot of the apostles, there's a lot of quotations from the Septuagint in the New Testament. And it gets back to that when Jesus talks about, have you not read that which God said to you? And he talks about Scripture. He's talking about Scripture that's just like our Scripture, meaning they didn't have the original documents. What they had was copies. And for the most part, because of the influence of the Greek culture, they had translation from the Hebrew language into the Greek language. And it was very popular. And the apostles and Jesus did not shy from it. They used it and they quoted from it. Well, the Vulgate translation uses the Septuagint here. And so it adds these words. And you may have the footnote on verse 6. It says, the tumors came and rats appeared in their land. And there was death and destruction throughout the city. And I know Bill talked about the thought is that this very well could have been bubonic plague. And I ran across something that made me think about that, if that was accurate or not, until I got to reading and studying more about the bubonic plague. And everything said about what's happening here will fit the idea of the bubonic plague. But in bottom line, they're not sure exactly what it was. The word tumor comes from a word that means swelling or protruding. And that still fits with the idea of what happened with the bubonic plague. Now, drop down to verse 9. In verse 9, there's a little more given. But after they had moved it, that's talking about the ark, the Lord's hand was against that city, throwing it into a great panic. He afflicted the people. Now, if you've got a translation other than the NIV, it will say afflicted the men. And the word can be men or mankind. It could be either way. But most of the translations, until you come to the NIV, will use the word men as in the male. He afflicted the people of the city, both young and old, with an outbreak of tumors. Again, the NIV will tell us that the Septuagint adds a word. And it is tumors in the groin. And bubonic plague was a swelling of the lymph nodes. And the swelling of the lymph nodes generally in the bubonic plague, took place under the armpit or in the groin area. And some of the translations, instead of saying groin area, will say in their private places or in their hidden places. And these growths, if you've ever seen a picture, the lymph node will swell and protrude out and become very painful. And when they protrude out, they're pretty good size when they protrude out. And this is what was happening to these people. If it is the same as the bubonic plague, then there's something scientifically very interesting about these tumors. Because not only are they identified with the ark, they're also identified with what? Rats. So to the point that when they want to give a gift to the god, when they send the ark back, they make gold images like unto the tumors and gold images like to the rats. And the bubonic plague, we all know, came from what? What was on the rats that infected the humans? The fleas. And so the fleas would come from the rats. And when the fleas would bite you, then that would be how the bubonic plague started with you. And so it could be something very similar to that, but this was extremely painful. And you can understand when that ark starts moving towards your city, the whole city gets into an uproar. You're not bringing it here. And they absolutely insist. And eventually the elders of the Philistines agree and they send the ark back. When they send it back, Kiriath-Jearim is where it winds up. It came back in an area from there, and the people were harvesting the wheat. And he told you about that. But Kiriath-Jearim is where it wound up because there were priests there. And it was turned over to one of the sons of one of the priests. And that's where it stayed for about 20 years. And that's where we start with chapter 7, which is actually the end of chapter 6. Now, I want you to look at these cities. We're going to get a story or history now of Samuel. And these are the cities that are going to be involved. Kiriath-Jearim is where the ark is. Ramah is where Samuel lives. And we mentioned this on our first class, that when he was weaned, his mother brought him to Shiloh, where the ark was at that time, and turned him over to the priest, intending for him to stay there for the rest of his life. When the priest died, where did he go? He went back home. And the boy that she gave away came back to him. And this is where he lived, in Ramah. But he runs a circuit every year from Mizpah over to Gilgal and to Bethel. And this would be in the mountain area. Then he'd come over here, which would be the quick way to come up down from Samaria. But those are the places where he went. But even when he was running that circuit, where he lived was in Ramah. And those are going to be the primary places that we're going to look at in these chapters. And just to give you an idea of where it was and the location of what's going on in chapter 4. Okay, so what happened to the people when they got the ark back? They decided to turn back to God. And when they decided to turn back to God, Samuel basically says to him, it's going to mean more than you think. Because if you're going to turn back to God, it's not going to be on your own terms. He doesn't use those words. But if you're going to turn back to God and you're going to return to Him with all of your hearts and get rid of all those idols, and you will not be serving anybody but God, it's not going to be a whole conglomeration of gods. It's not going to be polytheism. It's going to be worshiping God and God alone. And you're not going to have all of these different gods and worship them. That's what's necessary for you to return to God. Did they actually do that? No. Because it keeps coming up as a constant problem until eventually they go into captivity. But they don't continually do that. But this is what Samuel is telling them. That they are to commit themselves to the Lord and they're to serve Him and nobody else but Him. And He will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines. And that's exactly what happened. And so Samuel assembled everybody at Mizpah. And he began to intercede for the Lord. He began to offer sacrifices. He began to pray for them. Worship is mixed up. You wonder, when all this is going on, where's the tabernacle? And it doesn't say. Was it moved to Kiriath Jearim where the ark was? Or what happened to it? And it eventually will come back. But we're not given a great deal of detail as to what's going on with the tabernacle. And the priesthood is in disorder right now, or at least it appears to be. And they come at Mizpah. They don't go to where the ark is. They don't go to Kiriath Jearim. They come to Mizpah and they meet there. There they assemble. And the people are beginning to confess all the sins that they've committed. And they're pouring out their hearts before God. They're confessing their sins. And the Philistines hear about it. Guess what? They're in Mizpah. And so the Philistines come after them in order to attack them and in order to try to defeat them. And when the children of Israel see the Philistines coming, they are terrified and they cry out to Samuel, "You continue to entreat the Lord for us. You keep praying for us that the Philistines will not defeat us." And Samuel does, and God does. And if you've read ahead in the text, or if you're looking in the text, what does God do? Thunder. You remember when the thunder struck, the thunder sounded and the lightning struck on Mount Sinai? What was the reaction of the people on Mount Sinai? Because when God talked, it sounded like thunder. And they could see the mountain as if it was lit up in fire from all the lightning and the thunder that was taking place. And what did they ask? Huh? Yeah. Tell him to hush. And you go talk to him. And we'll listen to whatever he tells you. But don't let him talk out loud anymore. That's always intriguing. We always wish we could be in God's presence until you get there. And you always delight in the idea of, I want to hear God, I want to see God, until you get there. And I don't think there's a passage that talks about anyone being able to see a visual representation of God without the impact being that they are terrified and they fall on their face. And here it thunders. What's the loudest thunder you've ever heard? I was in Gadsden, Alabama. Thunderstorm came up. We were on the golf course. Forget I said that. We were on the golf course and we were in a shed waiting out the storm, and it quit. The storm moved on. Blue sky came out. We came out of the shed. We walked over to our golf balls. And we start walking down the fairway. 20 feet from me was a tree. The lightning hit it dead center, and the thunder was simultaneous. Everything about me stopped. Everything about me was about as scared as I have ever been. I had another one that was even closer. And thunder will get your attention, and so will the lightning. Used to be a joke, Lee Trevino would say, that what club do you use when you're in a thunderstorm? And he said, you use a one iron, because not even God can hit a one iron. 3 lightning strikes later, directly to Lee Trevino, he never said the joke again, because God hit his one iron. And it changed his whole demeanor about that. But they heard the thunder, and they were so scared and terrified that it threw them into confusion, and they started running. And then the children of Israel just went out and wiped them away because of what was going on, and they defeated them. With Samuel praying for them, and by what God was doing to them, they came out and they slaughtered the Philistines. Yes. Yeah. The Most High will thunder. Y'all ever had kids, your children, terrified of the thunder? And how many of y'all were? Well, you don't have to raise your hands. But when it gets when a bad storm comes up, it'll probably get a lot of our attention. Okay. When that battle was over, Samuel took a stone and set it up between Mizpah and Shin. We don't know where Shin is. It may be between Mizpah and Ramah. Shin may be an area around Ramah. But somewhere between there or around there, Samuel set up a rock, set up a stone, and he called it Ebenezer. And what he says about it is in connection with the name. And what he says is, thus far, the Lord has helped us. And the idea of it, y'all know the song that we sing, Here I Raise My Ebenezer. And what is meant by that song is, to this point, I have come by God's help. With everything that's gone on in my life, I am where I am right now because of God's help. And it's not a limiting thing that, well, he's helped us here once. No, Samuel is saying, I'm here with everything that's going on, with everything that's happening. Every part of my life has brought me to this point by God's help. And that's what that is in the song, and it's also what he means by it in this particular passage. So the Philistines were subdued. They didn't come into the land anymore for a while, at least not while Samuel was alive and while Samuel was leading. And some of the territory that the Philistines had taken, the Israelites take back, and they not only have no invasions coming from the Philistines, they are at peace with the Amorites. They are at peace with the people around them. And while Samuel is ruling and while Samuel is leading, then the nation of Israel has a very good peace and ability to live their own lives during the time that he is alive. Things are about to change. It lasted until Samuel grew old. When he grew old, he began to face the reality that he's not going to be here much longer. And so what Samuel does in chapter 8 is that he appointed his sons as Israel's leaders. The name of the firstborn was Joel, and the name of the second one was Abijah. And they served in Beersheba. I don't think we have Beersheba up there. But they served in Beersheba, and they had been appointed by Samuel to be the leaders. But his boys weren't like him. His boys come very close to being like Hophni and Phinehas. Maybe not to the point of the wickedness that Eli's sons were engaged in. But it says that his sons turned aside after dishonest gain, accepted bribes, and perverted justice. How important is that to God? To take bribes. To pervert justice in favor of somebody that you like. Or to pervert justice in favor of somebody that's kinfolk. I remember somebody making the comment, been a long time ago, that their brother was doing something wrong, but they were hiding it. And they were protecting him from it. And their reason was because blood is thicker than truth. Then you got major problems. If blood is thicker than what is right and what is true. And this is what his sons were doing. They were interested in gaining money. They were interested in getting rich for themselves. So they accepted bribes and they perverted justice. And so we have, what do you call this? When somebody needs to be talked to and a group goes and talks to him. Intervention? Yeah. So we have an intervention. This is intriguing. So all the elders of Israel gathered together and they came to see Samuel at Ramah. They have a problem, so they're going to him. Now, they probably already talked about it, but they knew what they needed to do. And so it's the elders of Israel, all of them. And they come to Samuel and they said to him, "You're old and your sons do not follow your ways." They said to him, you're old and your sons do not follow your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have. Look at this next verse. When they said, "Give us a king to lead us," this displeased Samuel. So he prayed to the Lord. What does that verse tell you about Samuel and about his reaction to this conversation? And about the way he heard this conversation. What did he not get angry about? Huh? I couldn't hear you. His sons. He didn't get angry about the fact that he was being told, "Your sons aren't like you." That's not what displeased him. Would displease him about his sons. But it's not what made him angry that these people, or for what these people were asking for. What made him angry was when they said, "We want a king like the nations around us." That's what displeased him. And that's when he went to God. And his prayer is not about his boys. It'd be interesting to know what he did with his boys. After this, it'd be interesting to know what conversations he had with them. It'd be interesting to know if this had been hidden from him and he was not aware of it. They weren't living with him, they weren't living around him. And maybe they presented themselves to him in a way that was not the way the rest of the nation saw them. But what upsets him is when they say, we want a king, like all the nations that are around us. So we went to God and he prayed to him. And what did God say? Listen to him. God had already in the law said, you're going to ask for a king. And when you have him, these are the rules he must follow. And that was already in the law. But he says this to Samuel. This is in verse 7. Listen to all that the people are saying to you. It is not you they have rejected, but they have rejected me as their king. But he knew that was going to happen. And he goes on to say, they have done this from the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt. The thing different now, Samuel, is they're treating you like they treat me. They are doing to you exactly what they've been doing to me. And now you understand what they are like. And now you understand my anger. And now you understand my frustration. Because they are doing to you exactly what they have been doing to them. So you listen to them. And you let them appoint themselves a king, but you tell them what that king's going to do. And you tell them what life is going to be like under that king. Okay. How long ago was this written? Thousands of years ago. And let's start reading in verse 11. When Samuel goes, he gets all the people together that are asking him for a king, and he says, this is what he's going to be like. And how far off is it? Still today. This is what the king who will reign over you will claim as his rights. Whose money is it when taxes are paid? Is it our money given to the government, or is it the government's money and they have the right to it? It's the government's money. And they say they have the right to it. And they don't look at it as if, no, it's our money, but we are proud of our country and we love it and we want to support it. And so this is what we're going to give. Doesn't work that way, does it? The book of Revelation ties in with this. And what God is beginning to describe for them is that whenever you have a government or a ruler, and he thinks he is the ruler, and everything must be done the way he wants it done, then you have the beast that's described in the book of Revelation. And our Constitution and our founding fathers set up our country to do everything that they could by the way we are ruled and governed to keep the beast from ever taking control. And really, what has brought us through all different kinds of presidents and senators and representatives is the Constitution. And the Constitution, the way that it's written with its checks and balances, is what has kept us the nation that we are. But boy, is it ever attacked. And it's not the first time it's been attacked, but it's been attacked. And we've lived through an attacking of it. Still are living through an attacking of it. But here's what he says about this king that you want to appoint over you. He will take your sons and he will make them serve with his chariots and horses, and they will run in front of his chariots. His sons will become his slaves. Some he will assign to be commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and others to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your field and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants. He will take a tenth of your grain and of your vintage and give it to his officials and attendants. How would you feel if our tax was a total 10%? Now that would be a celebration, wouldn't it? If all that the government needed and took was 10%, that would be a celebration. Your male and female servants and the best of your cattle and donkeys he will take for his own use. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his slaves. When that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. But the people didn't listen. They didn't care. They didn't think that was ever going to happen to them. And they said, we want a king. We want a king to rule over us like the rest of the nations. And so Samuel listened to the people. He heard what they said. He repeated it before the Lord. And the Lord answered, you listen to them and give them a king. So Samuel said, everybody go back to your homes. And so we come to chapter 9. And this is where it's going to start. When God became angry with Saul, there's a statement of comparison that God will make regarding what Saul was when God was angry with him and what he used to be. Does anybody remember what God said about Samuel? When I found you and anointed you as king, you were little in your own eyes. But not anymore. And that's what God says to describe, I said Samuel, what God said to describe Saul. When I first appointed you, you were little in your own eyes. We're about to read the chapter 9 that describes that littleness. This is not the Saul that we're going to have in just a couple of chapters. But this is the man God chooses to be the first king over Israel. And this is what God means when he says, you were little in your own eyes. And I find this study in chapter 9 just kind of fascinating. To look at the insight into what Saul was like and how he thought. And then compare that to me. Or compare that to the way so many of us are. So let's take a look. There was a Benjamite. That means he's from the tribe of Benjamin. He was a man of Benjamin. Who's Benjamin? Who's brother? He's half brother to everybody else, but he's full brother to Joseph. And he's the youngest. He's the one that daddy didn't want to let go back to the land of Egypt, but he's the one that Joseph wouldn't let him have any more food unless he came, and so he went, and Joseph intended to keep him there with him. And then the brothers begin to confess and acknowledge what they've done and what it would mean to their father if they came back and Benjamin wasn't with them. So this is that tribe. It's the Benjamite. There was a Benjamite, a man of standing, a man respected, a man looked up to. This was Saul's father. His name was Kish, son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Bechorath, the son of Aphiah, of Benjamin. And y'all like the way we just went through those names? Now, don't turn on your Bible program and see how a professional reader pronounces them. You can do that some other time. Kish had a son named Saul, as handsome a young man as could be found anywhere in Israel. Did he know that? Did he know that he was the most handsome guy in all of Israel? kind of answer that question as we go through. And he was a head taller than anyone else. They had a basketball team, he would be post. They had a basketball team, you'd want him on it. He was a head taller than anybody else. Now the donkeys belonging to Saul's father, Kish, were lost. And Kish said to his son, Saul, take one of the servants with you and go and look for the donkeys. So he passed through the hill country of Ephraim and through the area around Shalisha, but they did not find them. They went on into the district of Shilim, but the donkeys were not there. Then he passed through the territory of Benjamin. They did not find them. When they reached the district of Zeph. Now this is either a place that Samuel is visiting or it's an area right at Ramah where he does live. But they came to this place and Saul said to the servant who was with him, come, let's go back. Or my father will stop thinking about the donkeys and start worrying about us. What does that verse tell you about Saul? Now, they've been hunting for 3 days. We're going to find that out when they get with Samuel. And Saul says to his servant, let's go back home. Because if we don't, my dad's going to stop worrying about the donkeys. And he's going to start worrying about us. You can start anywhere you want to. But one of many things is the last word. My dad will stop worrying about the donkeys. And he will worry about us. Not me, us. And who was with him? A servant. Now, not only are we going to get insight into Saul, we're going to come to understand why it was that Kish was a man of standing. What else do you see just in this verse about Samuel? Huh? He was thoughtful. Thought about his father. What kind of relationship did he have with his father? Close. Respectful. Concerned about what he would think and how he would feel. Concerned about what I'm doing that might be causing him concern. Boy, isn't that a long way from what you typically see in attitudes toward parents and attitudes toward just about anybody of any kind of authority. But this was Saul. This is the heart God was looking at. This was the mind, the thinking process that God was looking at. And this is the man he had told Samuel is going to be the first king. And we begin to get a glimpse into exactly what he was like in relationship to his own dad. Look at that and compare it to the poor, poor, pitiful me's that, well, they don't care. My dad's not, he doesn't care about me. He doesn't care if I'm lost or not. Probably be better off if I don't ever go back. He's not speaking out of self-centeredness. He knows how his father loves him. And he loves his father. And he knows exactly what would be going on in the mind of his father. And he's truthful to himself about it. And he's truthful to others about it. We need to go back. Our dad will stop worrying about the donkeys. even though they're not there. And he'll worry about us. No anger if we go back without the donkeys. No anger if we fail in our mission. He's just going to be glad to see us. And he's going to be glad to see that we're safe. Even if he never sees the donkeys again. This man who was of this high standing, Saul knew we're more important to him than his possessions. We are more important to him than what he owns. We are more important to him than donkeys. And there were three donkeys. There was a servant and one son that were out. But he knew what his father would be thinking. The servant said, "Look, in this town there's a man of God. There's a man that belongs to God. There's a man that serves God. So this is Ramah. This is where Samuel lives. There's a man here, and he's so highly respected because everything he says comes true. Let's go find him, and perhaps he'll tell us which way to go to find the donkeys." Saul said to the servant, "If we go, what can we give this man? The food in our sacks is gone. We have no gift to take to the man of God. What do we have? We have nothing to give to him. Not going to take advantage of anybody." He goes, he's going to need help. He's not expecting it just to be given. He's wanting to pay. So the servant answered him, "Look, I have a quarter of a shekel of silver. I will give it to the man of God so that he will tell us the way to take." What does that tell you? Who had the money? The servant did. Saul looks in his bags and in his pocket and there's nothing. And look at the servant. There's no, I've got more than you. There's nothing like that. There's, I've got this and we can give it to the man of God and maybe he will help us. And the servant, it's almost like this servant and Saul are on equal footing. And he has possessions that at this moment outnumber what Saul has. And so that's what he says. And then there's this footnote, which lets us know that at this point, there's a footnote inserted that Samuel didn't write. Somebody later on is telling us what was meant at the time this story is written down. Formerly in Israel, if someone went to inquire of God, they would say, "Come, let us go to the seer, because the prophet of today used to be called a seer." So an insert is put in by one of the writers later on, and we know there's a couple of possibilities to who that might be. Might be Nathan the prophet. Might be some others that wrote later on. And they fill in the blanks in these stories and they give definitions, just like the apostles do for their readers and just like the apostles do for us. So why a seer? Could foretell, see what's in the future. But he could foretell and see what's in the future because what else was he seeing? Had a relationship with God, and God gave him visions. Yeah. Everything. But there's two sides to that. Everything he says comes true means he's saying what God says is going to happen. But then there's another phrase that the Bible uses that I find absolutely intriguing. And that is, God does not allow one of his words to fall to the ground. So if he said it, it's going to happen. And that's the way God was with Samuel. And not one of his words fell to the ground. Now, I don't think Samuel was an individual that would go around putting God to the test, but But I don't know that he always had visions for everything, but he would pray to God. And he did have visions with regard to what he's about to say to Saul, because God appeared to him the day before and told him everything was going to happen and told him what he was going to say and what everything about what was going on in connection with Saul. And so Samuel is already aware of it before they ever meet him. When Saul saw that the servant had the money, he said, "Good, come on, let's go." So they went out of the town. They found some people, some young women, coming up to draw water. And they asked if the seer was here. And she said, "Yes, he is." Or they said, "Yes, he is. If you hurry, you'll catch him, because he's just coming into the town. And if you'll hurry up on your way, you'll run into him." And so they hurry on along their way, and as they come over the hill, they looked, and Samuel is walking up the hill toward them. And when they see Samuel, we're told in verse 15 that about that same time, the day before, God has spoken to Samuel and said, "I'm going to send you a man from the land of Benjamin. I want you to anoint him ruler over my people, and he will deliver them from the hand of the Philistines. I have looked on my people, for their cry has reached me." God's having patience with his people and giving them what he doesn't want them to have. He wants them to trust him. Can you imagine the government of Israel? No prisons. Crimes were punished as they happened. And if you were unfairly accused, there were cities you could go, and a trial would take place. But there was punishment. It would be a beating, or it would be you paying back, and you restoring whatever it was you had damaged, or whatever it was you had taken. But no prison system whatsoever. And that was what they had with God's rule, and they had God's protection. But they don't pay any attention to God, and they start worshiping other idols, and then they can't figure out, why is God so mad at us and all these bad things happen to us? Well, duh. But he told them that's exactly what's going to happen. But they're wanting a king, and these people who are already rebellious, he's about to give it to them. When Samuel caught sight of Saul, the Lord said to him, "This is the man that I spoke to you about. He will govern my people." So Saul walked up to Samuel and he said, "Could you tell us, please, where the seer is, or where the seer's house is?" And Samuel said, "That's me. I'm the seer." And Samuel replied, "Go ahead of me to the high place, for today you were to eat with me, and in the morning I will send you on your way, and I will tell you all that is in your heart. Because all those donkeys that you've been looking for 3 days, don't worry about them. They've already been found." And to whom is all the desire of Israel turned, if not to you and your whole family? And Saul said, "Am I not a Benjaminite? I'm from the smallest tribe of Israel, and is not my clan the least of all the clans of the tribe of Benjamin? Why do you say such things to me?" He didn't say, "Well, it is true that I'm the most handsome man in all of Israel. And it is true that I'm a head taller than everybody else, so I really appreciate you finally recognizing who I am." Do you catch what Samuel has just said to him? He has just told him all the nation of Israel is going to turn in their desire towards you. And you will be the desire of all of the land and clans of Israel. You and your entire family line. And Saul understands what he's saying, but he says back to him, "You have me confused with somebody else. I'm a part of the smallest tribe in Israel, and I have the smallest clan in that smallest tribe. Why are you saying such things to me? Samuel brought Saul and his servant to the hall, seated them at the head of those that were invited, about 30 people. Samuel said to the cook, "Bring that piece of meat I gave to you and told you to hold for me." So the cook took up the thigh with what was on it and set it in front of Saul. Samuel said, "Here is what has been kept for you. Eat, because it was set aside for you. For this occasion, from the time I said, I have invited guests." And Saul dined with Samuel that day. You can almost imagine the confusion going on in Saul's mind. What does all this mean? This feast I've been invited to, and I didn't even know I was coming here. This man has prepared for me, and he's prepared all of it with me in mind. And there's a special serving that's been set aside just for me. What is going on here? After they came down from the high place, Samuel talked with Saul on the roof of his house. And evidently, they talked till daybreak. And you wonder what was said. I kind of think it was not about what's about to happen, but it's about what the law said the ruler of God's people should be like. And this seer, this prophet, I think, went over the law with this young man, Saul. Samuel called to Saul on the roof, and he said, "Get ready, and I'll send you on your way." When Saul got ready, he and Samuel went outside together. As they were going down to the edge of the town, Samuel said to Saul, "Tell the servant to go on ahead of us." The servant did so, "But you stay here for a while, so that I may give you a message from God." And what's about to happen is he's about to be anointed as king. And that's where we'll be next week in chapter 10 and chapter 11. Any comments or questions? That's a different Saul, isn't it? And the one we normally think about. And the one we normally read about. A different person. But when you think, going into it, he didn't think he deserved the kingdom. Near the end of his life, he didn't think it belonged to anybody else. And he became so angry that even his own son, he was willing to kill him because his son wouldn't recognize that nobody had a right to this throne except me and my descendants. And Jonathan didn't see it that way. And Saul tried to kill him, along with killing David. Completely different man from how he started to how he ended up, because he was given authority and power. And it went to his head. And he was no longer serving God. He was serving himself. Lesson for all of us to learn. Thank y'all. We'll see you next Wednesday night. Is everybody awake? We're dismissed.